Are there any questions on things we talked about in that first period? Things that were, I think, important to understand. What was the business about the right to left shunt, left to right shunt, the reverse of that shunt, when we're talking about congenital heart disease, and especially the reactive changes that occur in the pulmonary vasculature when they're subject to too high a blood pressure. Normally that's a very low pressure system. And what goes on there? Understand that. Understanding the complications of myocardial infarction and how that comes about. Understanding the basics of chronic ischemic injury. Low or decreased coronary blood flow doesn't necessarily lead to dead piece of muscle, but leads to myocardial weakness and the development of what we call congestive heart failure. Okay, and we talked about cardiac tamponade, what it means when we're taking a look at basically the most outrageous form of diastolic failure. We talked about heart failure from the sense of systolic failure, which was a defect in muscle beating strength, and the other was diastolic, which was the filling failure. And if you don't have enough blood, it doesn't matter how effective or strong the ventricle is, it's not going to do it. Okay, wrong way. So, are we okay with that? Okay. Well, looking at hypertensive changes, hypertension plays hell with the heart and the vessels all over the place. Most of the hypertension that we have is so-called essential, which is to say we can't point to a specific or single cause. Probably the most important thing is the amount of sodium that's in our diet. But in terms of pointing to it and saying, oh, it's due to a tumor that produces renin, or it's due to a tumor or angio, say, melt, you know, that produces epinephrine, or some screwy sort of thing. No, these do occur. These are modifiable things, but they're vanishing. They're quite small compared to what we call essential, which is what a lot of people have. Anything that impedes blood flow into the kidneys, we talked about aortic coarctation. But you see, if you had atherosclerosis in one kidney, that kidney would see itself as not getting adequate amount of blood. It doesn't understand that the problem is with the renal artery. So it's going to release a lot of renin. It's going to want to get the blood pressure up. Wants to have more blood pressure past that area of stenosis, of narrowing. So at any rate, there are a number of reasons, and we're looking in this image here at a whole variety of things that would be recognizable causes of high blood pressure, apart from essential hypertension, which is to say we don't know what the hell's going on. But this would be tumors that might produce something that would cause you to retain sodium, problems with kidney disease, dying kidneys, that sort of business. And these are all things that will increase the blood pressure. But for the most part, when we see hypertension in the average person, it's probably that we're just a little too high strung. We drink too much coffee, get too much caffeine, vascular constrictors. We eat too much sodium. We've got too much body fat, more resistance in the line because of the number of blood vessels we have. So there are a variety of things that add up to the biggest element of all, essential hypertension, and we just simply don't know all the factors that do that. What's going to be the cardiac complication or long-term outcome of high blood pressure is that the heart's going to work real hard. It's going to become hypertrophic. Remember, there were two terms that were applied to changing in kind of the amount of cells or mass of an organ. There was hyperplasia and hypertrophy. Hyperplasia was increase in numbers of cells. Hypertrophy was increase in the amount of tissue within a cell. In other words, hypertrophic heart doesn't have increased numbers of heart cells. It's just that all those heart cells are really big, fat, and meaty. So what we're seeing here is hypertrophy, not hyperplasia. And you might think, well, isn't that a good idea that you can get this big, meaty muscle heart? You know, it's like me working out. And the answer is no. That heart is very finely tuned to the amount of muscle, the size it has to be, the amount of work it's going to do in order to maintain our blood pressure. What happens also is that we see sort of reorganization of the way the heart is, the way the muscle is laid out in the heart, or at least the main beating contraction of the heart. Normally our heart doesn't just sort of beat and collapse on itself. It's actually got a particular cycle. As it starts to beat, as the left ventricle beats, it twists. The heart doesn't twist, but the contraction motion does. It's kind of like wringing out a washcloth or something. It sort of contracts and it sort of pushes the blood from the bottom up towards the aortic outflow tract. You see, if it went the other way, of course, it would try to push the blood the other direction. But at any rate, what it's doing is sort of collapsing from the bottom up to where the aortic outflow tract is, and at the same time, it's sort of a rotatory kind of twisting effect. what happens with hypertension is that we see increased muscle. Yeah.
What's the difference between, you know, the complaints that increase their hypertrophy here and someone who does a lot of exercise?
Yeah. Right. Actually, there's quite a bit of difference. It's a good thing you asked that, because what you will see there is that, surprisingly, there's only a small amount of hypertrophy. Even if you're a long-distance runner, your heart's slightly more muscular than other people's, but not a lot, maybe 5%, maybe 10 tops. But the muscle hypertrophy occurs in the particular areas where you want it to be, so that the beat goes from the base up to the, believe it or not, the base of the heart's the top, the apex is down here. It goes from the apex to the base, just like it's supposed to, and it sort of rings itself out. Now that's different than if you have, say, high blood pressure on the other side of the aortic valve, and the whole purpose is to open that door. That's all you're trying to do. In that case, what you see is circumferential hypertrophy. It's like an isometric exercise for the heart. Instead of sort of having the heart go through its normal beating, your blood pressure when you're exercising actually doesn't change a whole lot. What happens is your systolic goes up slightly, your diastolic goes down, and that difference between the two, known as the pulse pressure, gets bigger. And you can do that by doing it two different ways, you know, and the effect of how much blood is moving when you're really healthily exercising is substantially changed, almost by twofold. In this case, all you want to do is open the door. And so the heart becomes circumferentially hypertrophied, wraps itself around so it just squeezes like hell to try and pop the door open to put some blood out. That's quite a bit different than having hypertrophy if it's simply you're exercising and you're making more muscle where you want, the way it's normally constructed. The other thing you'll notice is that in this heart we see little peppered areas of that scar tissue. And we don't understand quite what's happening there, but you don't have good coronary blood flow, because when the heart has to beat so damned hard, it's squeezing itself to death to open up that aortic valve, it basically slows down the blood flow through into the muscle itself. As it compresses like that, you have reduced blood flow through the capillaries and so forth. Normally, you don't have that at the normal physiologic blood pressure. At higher blood pressures, it has to work so hard that the muscle contraction is so great it actually restricts blood flow in some areas. And so we'll see dropout and scar tissue and ultimately restriction of it. So the more muscle that we get, the less it's going to, the less it can work, believe it or not. You may think that this thing is now a really super duper sort of pumping machine, but not so. Another thing that happens, believe it or not, if you'll take a look at this, you'll see that the chamber actually gets smaller as the hypertrophy goes and goes. The amount of blood that the ventricle can hold before it contracts is decreased. So, we see left ventricular hypertrophy. This is a consequence of hypertension. Left ventricular hypertrophy, heart failure almost always, arrhythmias, more advanced atherosclerosis, stroke, dissection of the wall, breaking of the wall of the aorta, and so on. This is a section showing a very hypertrophied heart over here. You can see the papillary muscles are quite large. Again, it's a bread slice section of it. Now, that would have been what we're taking a look at there, was left ventricular hypertrophy, because it's working against a high pressure head. We occasionally do also will see right ventricular hypertrophy, and that's what we're looking at right here. Here's the right ventricle, and generally speaking, when we see that, it's either because the left ventricle has been chronically failing and backing up blood, and the right ventricle has to deal with it then, or we have some destructive process in the lungs, like emphysema or scarring conditions, that has led to decrease in the number of vascular channels. And if you have fewer vascular channels, then you've got increased resistance. It's again just like the situation we talked about in the first period, coming back from the mall, and all of a sudden you've all got to get into one lane on 3rd Street, right? In this case, we've got fewer channels for the cars to go on, everything's going to back up. And if we lose a lot of capillaries and so forth in the lungs, then there's decreased numbers of pipes and tubes for stuff to go through. There's increased resistance, which means there's increased pressure. And then the right ventricle becomes hypertrophied. So these are some things that will affect that, and that's what I've listed here, chronic embolization, where you may end up losing, again, vascular pulmonary vasculature. I have no idea what that has to do with anything, but that was kind of a hip picture, you know. All right, let's go on to valvular disease. Again, what we got to do here is create, moving walls. We've got to have doors between the chambers so that the blood moves one way and does not come back out that same way. These are passages that are only allow blood to flow in one direction. And so what are the problems that we can get into? Well, one would be if it's narrowed, stenosis. If it's stenotic and the door doesn't open very well or doesn't open at all. Another would be incompetent, and that would be if the door doesn't close properly and the blood is allowed to go back into the chamber that it came from. And the other thing would be crud accumulating on the valve margins. These valves are designed to be extremely slippery. Blood is not going to adhere. You're not going to have clot formation on them normally. But if you do and you have blood clots on it or infection on the valve itself, that stuff can fragment and embolize away. And when it does, it's going to take off, and if it takes off into the arterial flow, eventually it's going to clog up something. Now, here's an example of something that we still see. It's less common than it once was, but we see rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever actually is an autoimmune condition, and it involves all parts of the heart, the endocardium, the myocardium, the epicardium, the pericardium, but it also involves the joints. Rheumatic fever is named for the joints. That's the rheumatism part of it here. Rheumatic fever is an interesting problem. It is a type 2 hypersensitivity. Remember, there were four types of hypersensitivity. Do you remember what type 1 was? Huh? Allergies. IgE-mediated. Type 2 is a problem with antibodies that you make against self-constituents. Type 3 was antigen-antibody complex, where you've got antigen antibodies, bacterial or something like that are circulating, get stuck. And type 4 was the TB reaction, the T4 cell thing. This is a type 2. And what you do is you make an antibody against bacteria, Streptococcus, a particular variety of Streptococcus. It says type 2 there. So I kind of, okay, guess that wasn't quite as cagey as I thought. But at any rate, you have an infection here in the throat, and you make antibodies against the bacteria, and depending on the type, the strain of the strep, sometimes that antibody cross-reacts and make an antibody that is against the strep. Unfortunately, it also cross-reacts with your connective tissue, and that's what we're seeing here. And so the antibody will bind to connective tissue in the joints, around blood vessels, involving the heart, the myocardium, the epicardium, and so on. So then you have antibodies bound. If you have that, you're going to get complement fixed. You're going to trigger that whole immune cycle, and you're going to have inflammatory cells and polys and so forth accumulating wherever that is. That might be in the heart muscle, or it might be on the valves, or both. And in this case, it often involves the valves. And what we see here is a timeline showing the initial infection, and then it's gone. And then we see maybe 3 weeks to 4 weeks down the road, all of a sudden, oddball things start to happen to this person. They'll have swollen legs, painful joints, and that's when the heart issues will be coming forward. So it's not exclusively heart. It involves all kinds of connective tissue. Well, if you have an inflamed blood vessel, or inflamed a valve, it's not going to open and close as it should, and you're going to have crud, maybe even blood clot on the surface of it, and things are going to fragment away. These are showing some of the changes that we see with rheumatic heart disease, at least the acute phase of rheumatic heart disease. And connective tissue inflammation, perivascular, such as we see here, swollen joints, even sort of problems with the central nervous system. Again, related really to inflammation of the blood vessels. We're going to focus on the heart. Now, what's going to happen down the road can be real disastrous. And that is if we get endocardial, we're going to have both myocardial and endocardial inflammation. And if we have all that kind of inflammation, you can see kind of globs of stuff here on the valve margins. Down the road, that might mean a lot of scarring. And if you end up with scarred heart valve, it may not open right, and it may not close right either. It involves I've never seen it involving the right side of the heart. It always involves the left side of the heart. And there are people think it has to do with the pressures and so forth. But anyway, here you can see these little vegetations, which are inflammatory. These are not bacteria. The important thing to understand, the bacteria is totally gone from the picture. Bacteria was in the throat, it's dead, it's gone. What you've done is you've made an antibody that cross-reacts with this tissue. If you have a lot of scarring here in the myocardium, well, then you can't, the heart can't dilate, can't beat properly. So then we have this whole business about diastolic failure. And this is something that's going to occur months or years down the road. So we end up with junk on the valves that could embolize. We have scarring of the valves. We have scarring of the myocardium. and this is something that's going to go on the rest of their lives. And they could get that same bacterial infection again and have that antibody, have more production of the antibody and see more injury to the heart itself. So this is a real issue. The little microscopic section here is showing a section of one of these vegetations, and you'll see that it is basically all proteinaceous material, inflammatory cells, part of the immune reaction. And again, that junk will embolize and fly away. Here are some of the long-term effects that are going to happen then, where the valve margins, this is the aortic valve here, and this commissure is completely scarred closed. We've got scarring involving the mitral valve here. Again, it's always on this side. We might have had a lot of injury to the myocardium. We see initially what are called Ashoff nodules, and they look like little tiny granulomas. Eventually, they scar down, and if you got a blue million of those throughout the myocardium, all that scar tissue is going to limit motion, movement of the muscle. We even have involvement of the pericardium, as is shown here, which shows then scar tissue and trapping of a scarring of the pericardial sac to the surface of the heart, and then that can further restrict motion. All these things are downstream things that occur over a period of weeks and months down the road after the initial insult. And the bacteria, of course, was long gone. This is a type 2 hypersensitivity. This is a real valve right here. This is a mitral valve, kind of looks like an old catfish mouth. And in fact, that's what we refer to it as, a fish mouth. That sucker is neither opening right nor closing. It's both stenotic and incompetent. It's both. It won't open right and it won't completely close. And so blood comes across, a little bit of it does, and then part of it goes right back because the door didn't close. The problem with heart valves that are kind of scarred and you've got abnormal blood flow through the valve is that they're apt to become infected. Now, I said that rheumatic heart disease, rheumatic involvement, is autoimmune. It's type 2 hypersensitivity. And the bacteria is not there. But once you've damaged the valve and the altered blood flow, you can't end up with that heart valve becoming colonized with bacteria when you have bacteria in your bloodstream. Completely different, not strep, and not of any kind. It doesn't have to be a strep at all. It can be any kind of bacteria that's in your bloodstream. And you might think, not my bloodstream, Buster. I got a clean bloodstream here, you know what I mean? Did anybody have bacteria in their bloodstream this morning? Yeah, if you brushed your teeth, I guarantee you had lots of bacteria in there. But the immune system cleans them out of there before they can do much. Now, if you've got damaged heart valves like this and crazy blood flow across it, those are the valves that become infected. And so many years down the road, you can actually develop a true infective endocarditis. Bacteria now growing on a previously damaged heart valve that was damaged 15 years before. Okay, so or at least sometime before. So these are setting you up for something else. Here we're taking a look at removing these valves, how we replace them. There are a variety of valves now that can go in there, maybe pig aortic valves, things of that kind, mechanical valves. They never last all that long. After a few years, you may have to have it replaced. This is showing an interesting congenital thing that involves the valves, and that is Marfan syndrome. Marfan syndrome is worth knowing about because there's substantial ocular involvement here. Marfan syndrome is a connective tissue problem, which we wrongly thought for a long time had to do with elastic tissue. What it really has to do with is the assemblage of collagen and elastic tissue once it's secreted by the fibroblast. What happens is that you don't have it organized properly, and things that have a lot of connective tissue, particularly elastic tissue in it, the elastin doesn't really get assembled so that it works kind of like a springy rubber band. And it's an assemblage problem. There are many different versions of this. It's thought that Abraham Lincoln might have had Marfan syndrome, by the way. What we see here is a dilated aorta because there's a lot of elastic tissue in that aorta, and if it's not there in a healthy state, the aorta will dilate. Here we see mitral valve that's kind of crazy. This right here is a deformity that can occur actually about 2 to 3% of the population, so-called mitral valve prolapse, completely independent of Marfan syndrome. So this sort of thing happens in otherwise what would appear to be otherwise healthy people. The reason that they have problems with the eye is that the suspensory ligament for the lens is no longer competent, and the lens literally will fall out of the suspensory mechanism. And so, but this is listing then some of the problems that we can expect with somebody with Marfan syndrome, which involves the aorta, but also certainly the valves. And invariably, if this thing starts to dilate here, the valve leaflets no longer meet in the middle. One of my neighbors had a daughter with Marfan syndrome, and she had about, in the time I knew them, they lived next to us about 15 years, she had like two valves. She had to have a couple of valve jobs on her aortic valve because she was young. And of course, the valve isn't going to grow and size the way everything else is. So you have to replace it at a certain time, plus they simply wear out. But you can imagine if the valve thing touches, the valve leaflets don't meet in the middle. So if they don't meet in the middle and the valve is like this when it thinks it's supposed to be closed, is that a stenotic valve or an incompetent valve? Right. It's incompetent. The door doesn't close right. And so a lot of the blood comes right back into that ventricle, a lot of wasted motion. this is mitral valve prolapse, so-called parachute deformity that we might see. and here we got the left atrium. It's all kind of stretched out. And here we can see the valve like this. Here's the left ventricle. This, as I say, is not uncommon. I don't know really what it's due to. About 3% of the population have it. We don't get too worried about it. We can hear it. Actually can hear a clicking sound when that valve, when the parachute snaps open. And if it's really a serious problem, then we'll go ahead and go in and repair the valve. In this case, we don't typically replace the valve. We'll go in and actually remove extra tissue and try to repair the valve. Zunheit. But it's also associated with, it's a marginally an increased risk, not a lot, but of cardiac arrhythmias and infection of the valve. So here's true infective endocarditis. Here's the bacterial infection of the heart valves. And this can occur in an otherwise healthy person who just simply has the bad luck of getting something like a staphylococcus in there. It colonizes the valves and destroys the valves. It's more likely that it's going to occur on a previously damaged valve, something that was either genetically abnormal or something that was something like a rheumatic heart disease where you had scarred valves and altered blood flow. And the vegetations we see here are actually bacterial colonies and blood and stuff like that, coagulated blood. And when that embolizes off, it carries the bacteria with it. So if you have a fragment of that go up here and cause a stroke, it also carried bacteria with it. They're going to start proliferating, and you're going to end up with an abscess where the dead tissue is. So infective endocarditis is an incredibly serious problem. Again, I would show you a movie, and I will put it in right here later. The aortic valve can be clearly seen in the middle of the field. Note the junk bouncing back and forth on the valve edges. What do you think would be the consequence of some of this stuff breaking free? That shows some of this infected crud bouncing back and forth. I mean, it's a big wad of snot. It's kind of like, imagine, you know, your folks, go to a trip, go to Southwest or Mexico or something like that, and they bring you back one of these things where it's got a cup and a handle and a ball on a string, and you're supposed to flip it and get it in the, you know what I mean? And really all you ever do is slap yourself in the eye with it. And then eventually you realize you can use it as a little whip to beat your sister, you know what I'm talking about? Well, this is what this stuff looks like. This stuff is bouncing around and flying all over, and eventually the ball flies off the string and away it goes. And in that case, big chunks of this stuff fly away. Here's an interesting thing. A chord of tendon here on this mitral valve was completely torn away. Okay, we're going to move on to cardiomyopathies, and that has to do, as you can imagine, the myopathy refers to the muscle itself, problems with muscle function. And I'll grant you take a look at this and say, That's interesting. What's this big glob of poop right here? What's this up here? I thought we were going to be talking about the myocardium. Well, when the myocardium gets sick, whether it's inflammatory in nature or toxic in nature, such as alcohol, it just doesn't beat effectively. It's weaker and weaker, and the blood flow through the chambers is somewhat slowed down. You have a greater retention. You know, when your heart beats right now, everybody here, I'm going to say everybody's perfectly healthy, and when your left ventricle beats, it doesn't evacuate every bit of blood that's in there. A so-called a good ejection fraction, that is the percentage of blood that leaves, a good one is about 75%. That's it. It doesn't completely wring itself dry. About 75% of the blood that was in the ventricle, not the aorta when it was all over. In this case, we might see a 30% ejection fraction. So there's a lot of stagnant blood sitting in that left ventricle. Why? Because the ventricle is weak. It just doesn't care. Maybe there's scar tissue in there and it can't move. Or maybe toxic injury from heavy metals like mercury or something like that. Or viral infections. And it's sort of weak and it's dilated. And you have a lot of retention of blood in the ventricle. And so it's slow flowing. And slow flowing blood is the kind of thing that's going to try and clot. It'll do it kind of on its own spontaneously. And then you end up with clots here, so-called mural thrombus, that is the blood clot on the wall. That's why we call it like intramural sports. And that thing can fragment away, and away it goes and embolizes. God, was that a disaster of a game on Sunday? I mean, it was an embarrassment. I had a feeling that when they got, you know, when Denver got into the, what do you say to the team? When the very first, you hike the ball the first time and it flies over the head down at the end zone, next thing, on the very first move, you got a safety. I mean, this is not a very propitious kind of beginning, you know, is it? The commercials were pretty good. I liked them. Not as good, I will tell you, not as good as the old days when we had frogs selling beer. I thought those were the greatest. You know, iguanas and frogs and stuff like that. Although they didn't predominate in this case, if in previous games, one of the interesting commercials that I see a lot for happens to be a blood thinner. They take and they talk about somebody who has has a dysfunction, and they have atrial clots forming. And it's the old man and the daughter, they're looking over, you know, they're looking on the website, do you know the one I'm talking about here? And they're talking about this new medication that's better than Coumadin or something of that kind. You don't have to go in for the regular stuff. I think it's fascinating when you see a football game like that, and it's either sexual dysfunction. It's either going to be problems with, you know, getting it up, or it's going to be beer. It's going to be trucks. And what's next is going to be, you got to be taking this medication to prevent this blood clot from forming right here. I mean, where have we gone? It's amazing. Well, pizza, too. We got pizza thrown in there, too, you know. Those are the five basic, you know, commercial groups. That's it. Medication-related. Well, what's going on in elderly people is that, again, if you have slow flow through here for a variety of reasons, you have stagnant blood here or up here in the atria, it's going to clot, and you're going to develop a mural thrombus. And so, lo and behold, here on the, you know, in between the parts of the football game, they're talking to your doctor about medications to help prevent these clots formation in your heart. And the reason is it's going to embolize, it's going to fly out of there, you're going to have a stroke and die. And that can be either because you have a cardiomyopathy or a myocarditis. That's one of the two possibilities. The other is it just happens. Let's go back for a moment. Cardiomyopathy, you see, is saying there's an apathy. There's a disease of the cardiac muscle. The myo is the muscle. The apathy business is the pathos, the pathology, the suffering. But you don't see the itis in there. What is if it ends up with itis at the end of it, what is it telling you about the underlying nature of the injury, injurious process? It's inflammatory in nature, myocarditis. See, a cardiomyopathy could be, again, due to toxins like beer, believe it or not. It's one of the leading causes of cardiomyopathies. Old inflammation, a whole variety of things. And just says, you know, it doesn't work like it's supposed to. And if we look at it post-mortem or do a biopsy, and by the way, we do biopsy hearts, by the way, occasionally, We don't see inflammatory changes. We don't see inflammation. Now, myocarditis is a different matter. You see, we just talked about one already with rheumatic heart disease. That's a form of myocarditis. It was autoimmune in nature, but there was inflammation there. We can have bacteria and viruses, infected viruses can go there. So there are a variety of things that will infect. And here we're looking at a section of cardiac muscle with lots of inflammatory tissue in there, or inflammatory cells in there. And what that means is that the muscle just simply isn't working for crap. It's inflamed. And inflamed muscle, here you can see scar tissue that's in there. Inflamed muscle that isn't working and inflamed endothelium is going to lead to platelet aggregation. Platelets are aggregating at the site, is going to mean clot formation. And so here we're looking at mural thrombus. Person who has a cardiomyopathy, and particularly a myocarditis, has a very weakly beating heart. They will go into heart failure and often die with that. You can imagine if the inflammation disturbs the rhythm, the electrical system of the heart, you'll have rhythm disturbances and so forth. And this, I'm sorry to say, is in your age group. We see this in people in their 20s and 30s. Here's an example, pericardial disease. Let's see where we are here on these notes. Oh my God, we're almost done. So when we're looking at the actual heart itself, we were on the endocardial side, we moved through the muscle, now we're coming out onto the pericardial and the sac that it's in. The pericardium is there to kind of serve as, it almost serves like a joint in a way, in that it's a sac with a little bit of lubricant in it, because the heart is always moving. I mean, it's always moving, it really is, I mean, it moves a lot. And so what you've got is a very a slippery lining and a small amount of lubricant fluid in there so that it can kind of move around unimpeded. And the pericardium is continuous. Unfortunately, a variety of things can infect the pericardium, either autoimmune in nature. Well, we're back to rheumatic fever again. Rheumatic fever, remember, that was connective tissue, very generalized antibody that's going against the connective tissue. So we could have rheumatic fever involving the pericardium. In fact, that's what this is. This picture is that. But you can also have viral infections. Lyme disease is a classic one. One of my friends who lives about three blocks away from this building and has a bunch of deer in her backyard came down with Lyme disease. You can have pericarditis. You can have a variety of things with the Borrelia burgdorferi, is that organism. And you get it from, you know, deer mice. You probably know the whole whole shtick with Lyme disease, yes? You get it from the little ticks, the little Ixodes ticks. And it's harbored in the deer and the deer mice and so on. Other things, other systems that are failing may then in turn lead to problems with pericardial function and accumulation of fluid in there. Kidney failure is one of those. And one of the odd things that happens with kidney failure is that as you lose the capacity to pee out nitrogenous waste like urea and uric acid and so forth, and as they build up in the bloodstream, since they're water-soluble, perfectly water-soluble, they're going to end up in all your body water. And that includes the fluid that surrounds, that little bit of lubricant fluid that surrounds the heart. And it's either toxic to it, and in some cases it actually reaches the point where it kind of crystallizes and it's sort of like crud in there. And as the heart moves and beats, it keeps scraping against it. So oddly enough, renal failure can lead to a picture quite similar to this. Not infectious at all. It's just a matter of having these inborn or these internally derived toxic agents. Cancer does not develop here. I have never seen a malignancy develop in the pericardium, but cancers will spread there. Lung cancer, just because of the proximity alone, here's the lung right there next to it. Lung cancer can directly invade it, and that does happen. Others will actually spread by means of the bloodstream. Breast cancer probably is the most common one to do that, and we'll actually have malignant cells in the circulating fluid here or involving the wall of the pericardium. So I've never seen anything that actually is primary cancer, primary tumor in the pericardial sac, but you can have things that'll spread to it. Well, when the inflammation is done, if we're taking a look at this thing here, and all that scar tissue that's left behind is going to completely restrict. It's going to be binding the pericardial sac to the surface of the heart, and it's just going to make it a rigid mess. It can't move effectively. And if it ever really needs to, if you were trying to exercise and you'd like to have a little more blood volume in there and pushing it out while you're, say, you know, jogging, it can't do it because it's restricted in its motion. So we refer to this as a restrictive pericarditis. Well, so it may go through the actual itis phase where it's inflammatory, and then later it's purely scar tissue, and it's, I guess at that point we wouldn't say itis, but at any rate, that's the situation with the pericardium. So once we even get out on the very surface of the heart, we're not home free. This is showing some changes here in the pericardium actually following surgery. This person had revascularization surgery. They have to get in, they have to split it and get into the pericardium to work on the heart and reroute the vessels and so forth. And in this case, this is an autopsy picture, as you can imagine. And you can see how rough, normally the heart would be very glistening, and you can see how rough the surface is. And so postoperatively, this is a problem. We do try to control that in people who've had coronary bypass surgery to prevent that, but some people, irrespective of the medications we put them on, to kind of slow down the immune, the reparative process there, it still goes ahead and we wind up with a lot of scarring and restriction of motion. So other things that could happen beyond just the business of scarring of the pericardium, if we have fluid accumulate out there, which will accumulate with congestive heart failure. If we have fluid, of course, it's going to compress the heart so the heart can't move terribly well. We've already talked about blood getting out there very acutely. If the fluid accumulates, the effusion accumulates slowly, say as in congestive heart failure, the whole thing may stretch a little bit, and so it's not quite as catastrophic. But still, tapping off that fluid from the person dramatically changes their ability of the heart to work in the case of someone with congestive heart failure. The long-term effect, as I've just described, is scarring and so forth, and then you're really in a world of hurt. This is showing a ruptured heart, which, by the way, can be traumatic. It doesn't necessarily have to be myocardial infarction. This right here happens to be that. I believe that's from myocardial infarction he's displaying here. This is showing the amount of blood out here in a cardiac tamponade, and again, acutely, it doesn't take much blood because the sac can't dilate. If fluid accumulates very slowly, it might stretch some. But you can lacerate. You can either break the heart, you can either fracture the heart, or the aortic root right here, say rotatory motions in particular, deceleration injury, if you will, where you're suddenly stopped, you come forward, and the heart rotates, it'll literally unscrew itself. It'll rip itself loose at the aorta, and then the blood flows down in here, and the person dies with cardiac tamponade. So those would be sort of things that might occur acutely, leading to what we call a hemopericardium. And that's basically the story. Any questions? One of the things that we do, as you probably know, are heart transplants, heart-lung transplants. And we have a transplant service up in Indianapolis. And depending on how successful we are with the immune suppression, can go for a long, long time. But there's a whole collection of problems that come about with that, and that typically is related to the immune suppression and then infections that occur, particularly development of tumors elsewhere, because part of the suppression is you might be surprised to know that you had cancer this morning. Did you know you had cancer this morning? You did. Sorry to tell you that you had cancer this morning. Statistically speaking, you have 4 malignant cells develop every day in your body. When you just take a look at the number of replications that go on in everyday life, you will end up with 4 cancer cells every single day. To your immune system, your T cells sniff it out and kill them. And if you squash the T cell response, one or two of those rascals are going to make a leap to hyperspace and they're going to start growing. So part of the problem that we see with any kind of transplant, whether it's heart or whatever, is going to be down the road will be a tumor development, particularly of the lymphoid line. Okay, well, that was a bit of an aside. Any questions? All right, this material is obviously not on your test on Thursday. This comes up in the second exam. That third exam is going to be a bear, isn't it? God, I looked at that and I thought, thank God I'm not in here. That's it for me. As I said, I'm going to output this, and a couple of movies I have, I will put in there if you want to see them, fine. All right. Well, thank you all. Take care. Mm-hmm.